Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off. Just making a quick little note of something because I can't multitask. Here we go. We're off. We're back. We're here. We're off the chain. That's right. We're back after all.
On the air and off the chain.
On the air and debonair. That's what they'd say if we were being
debonair.
In a movie coming to not a cinema but streaming soon. It's called DJ Spies, and it's there on the air and debonair. See, that's how you pitch stuff.
And how did that pitch go?
Los Angeles, really well actually. I'm making a
pilot.
Making a pilot.
DJ Spice.
It's about pilots. They're in the air, and they're spies. You see, they're pilot spies.
Debonair is air. It's not really the main thing you need to be a spy.
Whoa! Let me finish. And debonair. What were you saying?
I was saying. Being debonair isn't necessarily the first thing you need to be a spy.
Like, what else do you need to be?
Be able to, like, be a spy. That's just about dressing up, isn't it? Hasn't got any of the sort of surveillance skills that you'd probably need to be a spy. To be the sort of, to sort of blend in. In a way, you probably don't want to be a spy and be super good looking. You want to be able to blend in, be like an average Joe, probably.
That's very, very nice of you to say that I'd never make a spy. But thank you very much. Probably don't go around using your actual name either, right?
Yeah.
Hi, my name's Bond, James Bond. What, the spy? No. No. I'm a wig groomer. Are you looking at my wig? No. Are you wearing a wig? It's groomed very well. Of course, I know. Anyway, let's play Baccarat. So that's obviously taken from the books, because in the films he plays poker, but in the books it's...
And it also makes sense because you've sort of created your own character there rather than do an impersonation of one of the existing film actors. So it's a good... That's how I understood it, was from the book.
I'm not an idiot, mate. I'm not an idiot. Why? Don't talk to me, please. I've asked you off air and now I'm going to ask you on air. Don't talk to me like I'm an idiot. Yeah? I'm aware Daniel Craig has only got like maybe 5 more movies in him, and then they'll be looking. They'll be looking for someone else. And I reckon that person that they're going to look for...
Yeah.
Is, you know, probably English, Irish, Scottish, Northern Irish, Australian.
Sure.
You know, Welsh. They've had a Welsh guy, haven't they? Timothy Dalton was Welsh. Sean Connery was Scottish. Mm-hmm. Roger Moore was English.
I guess.
Pierce Brosnan is Irish. And George Lazenby was Australian. Bob Holness, obviously, the first ever James Bond, from the radio show Casino Royale. Uh-huh. He was English? Was Bob Holness English? Natalie, look that up. Where was Bob Holness from? I saw in the week, it wasn't this week, it was a week, James Brolin auditioned to be the next James Bond.
That's probably why he plays the Bond-like character in Master of Disguise. So it's really good casting of that film. Clever.
Well, they've got all the screen tests of James Brolin, and he did it in an American accent. So they were going to, I think after Roger Moore, they were going to cast him. Or maybe, was it Diamonds Are Forever? After Diamonds Are Forever?
Yeah, the reason why, isn't it? Because I heard that... is he called John Gavin, the guy who's in the sort of male lead in Psycho. He was going to be Bond at one point, and apparently, like, signed on to do it as well. Yeah, for Diamonds Are Forever, I think. The one where Connery comes back. And I think they were just going to go, do you know what, let's forget about him being English. He can just be American. And I think Adam West was considered at the same time.
Well, so I'm saying that strange things have happened. I could be Bond.
Sure. Sure. Apparently, Bob Holness was born in South Africa. So,
we've had a South African. We've had an Irishman.
Yeah.
We've had an Englishman, a Scotsman, a Welshman. And I think it's not outside their realm if they said this time our James Bond is going to be a cunt.
The first one.
I don't want to talk about James Bond. Oh, no.
What's your name?
My name's Nick. Nick Helm. I got it wrong. Oh, it's Helm. Nick Helm. Yeah, so my name's Nick, and this is...
Nathaniel Metcalf. No, I've done it wrong as well. Metcalf. Nathaniel Metcalf.
Oh. And we have a license to thrill. on the airwaves. We're on the air and debonair. That's us. We I've said it once, I've said it twice. Do not make me say it again.
Third time.
Well, that was the third time. I was hoping that people would overlook that.
This show is called...
The Fan Club.
Fan Club.
I knew that.
Yeah.
Fingers on Buzzers. It's not called Fingers on Buzzers. That's another podcast. This isn't a podcast. It's a radio show that later becomes a podcast. Mm. That's avoiding any...
It changes state like a butterfly. You might be listening to this and it's a radio show, or you might be listening to it and it's a podcast.
It's just like a butterfly. So it's either a butterfly or it's a dead butterfly. Just the circle of life, baby. I'm having problems with my audio. I can't hear very well. Is it because I've got the headphones over my hat, I wonder?
Oh, maybe. I can hear you fine.
Oh, I'm not saying that there's a problem coming out of my radio, station, my office. Oh, God, yeah.
Nick, what is the first rule of the fan club?
Still forging ahead, are we, Nathaniel? This show... Some 10 minutes in with first rule of fan club, tell your friends about fan club.
Yeah. Second rule of fan club, tell your friends. I think it makes sense though, because we can do it 8 minutes in, because in very much like the Bond film, we're still on our last case.
We've had our cold open. Where James Bond has been going, I reckon I could be the next Bond. And then the film starts, and then he is.
He has a psychedelic sort of title sequence. And then it kind of opens, and then it's less exciting for a bit. It's usually just wandering around corridors and being a bit smart ass to old M. That's how they usually start.
But he's doing this one over the radio. And she goes, oh, Bond. I'm sick and tired of you being on the air, and I'm assuming debonair. He goes, you've assumed correctly. I've got my tie. Are you doing 007 from the 70s and 80s? Yes. I thought I could... keep him alive via the airwaves. No, just be yourself. And then that's like the big lesson that he learns in that film, is to just be himself. And he's just like, yeah, do you know what? I am. I'm just going to be myself now, which is a good lesson to learn. Unless you're a fucking spy, he goes out, they get shot instantly, and then they've got to fucking start the rigmarole of recasting him again. My money's on Idris Elba. So let's go.
Idris Elba is he must be knocking on a bit to be Bond, though, isn't he?
Well, you say
surely
that.
Like, bro, Daniel Craig, what is he? And what is he, mid-50s now? And he's kind of said, and he's like going, I'm not doing any more after this. But they won't even release the one that's finished. It's just like, so it'll never come out. Idris is 48. So that means if he does like one film in 3 years, he'll be 51. So he could probably do a couple maybe before it's a bit like, I'm not doing any more.
Daniel Craig's 53. You're forgetting. So that means that Daniel Craig must have been like, what, 36 when he's first donned. I hate James Bond so much. Why are we talking about James Bond? So he must have been about 36 when he first dons the mantle of the cold-blooded assassin killer.
James Don.
And Idris Elba at 48. Yeah, he may be a bit too old now, but you're forgetting that Roger Moore was well into his 60s by the time he first became Bond. Have you seen the trailer for the Suicide Squad?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I think that is. I know that they've been making it for a while, and the whole. I just think that the whole. scenario, the whole set of events that has led to, I mean, you used to work in a comic book shop. How many titles does DC have?
Oh, like that they could plausibly, I mean, thousands probably, that they could plausibly make into a film.
They can make anything. Did we talk about
it's weird that there will have been two Suicide Squad movies. I'll say that.
Well, I would say this is the whole thing, isn't it? It's sort of like what's the other film that they did that with? Justice League. So they released Justice League. People hated it, so they remade Justice League with existing footage. They didn't remake it. They retro made it. They went back to the first cut and then they finished that off, and then they re-released Justice League. And Justice League did very well because of all the publicity of releasing a 250 million piece of shit that probably made a bit of money, but not as much money as they were hoping. And based on... So my point is that the Suicide Squad came out in 2017. I've said this, I said it last week or the week before. I walked out of it in the cinema. I hated it. I would say, because I'm a big fan of DC, probably more so than I am now. Not the movies, just the vibe. But I used to get those animated movies that they released, and they released the Suicide Squad a few years ago, which was okay. It wasn't brilliant. It was okay, animated. So I was sort of aware of the Suicide Squad. It seems like a really simple concept to how this is how you do it. It's like the Dirty Dozen, only with Batman villains. Great. They get released out of prison. They go on a mission. It's a suicide mission. And they get, like, pardoned or time off their sentence. It's an easy concept. So it was sort of ridiculous how badly they fucked up the first film. But I would argue the reason most people, casual cinema goers or humans, if they're aware of the suicide at all, it would mainly be because of that first movie that was a huge disaster.
Yeah.
So now what we've got is a couple of years later, James Gunn got fired by Disney from the Marvel universe from directing Guardians of the Galaxy 3. He did Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2. James Gunn started off writing films like Romeo and Juliet, absolutely disgusting films. Did he do Terra Firma as well? Disgusting films for Troma. Brilliant. Entertaining. I haven't seen it since I was at university, though, so I don't think you're probably allowed to watch them anymore. Like, awful.
Bad taste films, aren't they? They're just
very bad. Deliberately low budget, not deliberately low budget, but deliberately bad taste because they're so low budget. They got nothing to lose, really, from Troma. And he started off making these things, and then he's sort of like, that's how he, he did the film Slither, he did the film, was the film called, it wasn't called The Wrench, was it? Was it called Super?
Yes, yeah.
where the bad guy, where the good guy was called the Wrench, and it was sort of like came out about the same time as Kick-Ass, but again was disgusting. And yeah, entertaining, but sort of images in that film that have burnt into my brain for all time. Tell your friends. And in between that, he wrote like the Scooby-Doo movies. So James Gunn has had like this career, and then he's made all of these really controversial films. And then Disney were like, "Oh, let's get him to do the Marvel films." And it's kind of like, "Yeah, yeah." I mean, he's a good idea, good idea. But you know, anyone that really enjoys Guardians of the Galaxy and digs into his, you know, back catalogue, they're going to be, you know, if you've come there via Disney, then you're going to be in for a treat, yeah. Right?
And that is fine because he knows he's making a PG-13 movie, so it's fine. Nothing's going to be bad happening.
Yeah, as a filmmaker, he knows how to make it. Do you know what I mean? I haven't got a single... I'm not saying anything about James Gunn. I'm just saying...
Or Disney's initial reason to do it isn't that. Like, it's like, oh, we'll get that guy, but we'll get him to do a... We want it to be a bit edgy, but we want it to be PG-13, I guess, or a bit... They want to get a bit of that in a Marvel film.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they're thinking outside the box, aren't they? Mm. And they're saying, Guardians of the Galaxy, they're outside the box, they're a bit edgy, so let's get James Gunn in. He's outside the box, he's a bit edgy. He's done some sort of, not blockbusters, but he's worked in the superhero genre before with Super, and he's worked with special effects before, and he's a writer and director. You know, he does everything. I'm sure I'm missing out something big that he did.
But also, it was an interesting one to do because it, even as a comic, it wasn't a big comic. It seems so odd that they would go for this property that wasn't terribly well established or anything, but they're going to put all their chips of the, they're building up this universe, and then they go, oh, our next movie is this one, it's Guardians of the Galaxy, and it felt a bit, well, that seems like an odd one to go for. Cause,
well, it's sort of like a... But it's a franchise that's sort of based around that, isn't it? Their first film was Iron Man, which was kind of like a second-tier character at best. Yes. Your layperson doesn't really know who Iron Man is. I was only really even aware of Iron Man because in the 90s I was into films and I knew that Tom Cruise wanted to make it. But that's how I knew. I didn't go into anything further than the fact that he's called Iron Man. So that's, you know... but then Iron Man became a household name, and then it was just like, well, what else have we got that's like that, that's obscure, that we can kind of give the Iron Man treatment to? And they went even more obscure with Guardians of the Galaxy, and they got that director. Fine, great. Then people dug into his past and were like, oh, it's a bit dodgy. And you go, you knew that when you hired him. Mm-hmm. Well, he's not very Disney, though, is he? And you go, yeah, well, you knew that. It's not just sort of like digging up. It's not going out of your way and finding old tweets that he did. It's just watching the films on his IMDb. Romeo and Juliet is disgusting. Terra Firma is disgusting. There's jokes in that he wrote that are just, you know, borderline, if not 100%, unacceptable.
It's a very corporate way of dealing things. It's immediately distancing yourself from something that you already knew about. So it's like, oh, no, he didn't know about that. And yet, but that only came to light because he did an interview or something where he basically made a point of saying, oh, yeah, well, you know, I've made jokes in the past that I'd never make now. I'm sure if you looked at my Twitter feed, you'd find offensive jokes that I made 10 years ago that I just wouldn't do now. And so someone went, well, let's do that. And they go, oh, I found one. Found one where you joked about paedophilia. Therefore, you need
to... But they didn't find one, did they?
They didn't what?
They didn't find one.
Oh,
they
no.
They found 100,000.
Yeah, but like also, that, it's also someone saying...
But that was his thing.
Making a point of saying, yeah, that's his point, is saying, oh, I used to make loads of jokes that I wouldn't make now. So it's like, yeah, sure. And that's what he's saying. That's sort of changed. I've grown a bit as a person, and I wouldn't do that now. And then they dig him out and use it as a way to get him fired.
But what happened with Justice League was they hired, they got rid of Zack Snyder, and they hired the guy that did Avengers for Marvel, Joss Whedon, who has since undergone, no pun intended, a lot of controversy, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Who's basically been cancelled, right?
But
so time, rather than
the golden boy, he was the golden boy when they hired him.
Well, they were literally just like, we don't want a Zack Snyder film. We want something exactly like the Avengers that Marvel did, which is so sort of like, I mean, oh, well, why not just hire the guy that did Avengers? You know, that's crazy.
Yeah. Or if you wanted that, maybe you should have done that to begin with, if that's what you were after.
But they were locked into this. I mean, it's like this domino effect where Christopher Nolan was finished with Batman and who wrote, what's his name? Who wrote Dark Knight? David Goyer. And Christopher Nolan said to David Goyer, have you got any pitches for Superman now that we've finished with Batman? Have you got any ideas for Superman? And David Goyer took like 20 minutes apparently and he just was like, yeah, there you go. This is what I'd do with Superman. And Christopher Nolan said, I'd produce that. And then they went to Warner Brothers and said, what about we do Superman next? I don't want to direct. And then they almost auditioned Zack Snyder. You know, people had to come in and pitch to them. And Zack Snyder came in and did it. And then so everyone goes, oh, Superman's so moody and all of this stuff. It's all Zack Snyder's fault. It was Christopher Nolan and David Goyer that pitched it. Mm-hmm. Then they like lit the fuse, walked away. Man of Steel was enough of a hit to get a sequel, but as you said, Zack Snyder wasn't really interested in Superman and really wanted to make a Batman film, so the sequel to Man of Steel was Batman versus Superman. Then he gets Justice League, by which point Warner Brothers are like, it's all a bit dark and moody, so it's too late to go.
They've played it all badly, though. The whole thing is silly, because they've done everything is like a reaction to the most recent thing, isn't it? So they basically, after Justice League comes out, they've basically gone, forget it. We're not going to do another Superman film. We hate that. We hate, what's his name? Henry Cavill. We hate him. We're not doing another film. Then Aquaman comes out and is a big hit. And then they're like, no, we might actually. And it's like, stop. Just like play your cards closer to your chest.
Stop telling everyone what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, Ben Affleck says he's definitely going to do the Batman film so long as the script isn't shit, announced Warner Brothers. By the way, Ben Affleck's just pulled out this Batman film. So you're basically telling people, well, that was going to be a shit film. It's like, everything's too in public. It's like, why do we know this stuff? It's like, keep your cards closer to your chest. It's like, if it's, you could do this a lot classier and not upset anyone. And then they sort of go, oh, maybe we do want Henry Cavill back. And it's like, we've already told him to go fuck himself or whatever. It's that sort of like, why don't you just not do that? Or go like, we're it's early days. We're just seeing where to go next and seeing where
it lands. Make one good film. And then if that's... And then like, have like on a piece of paper ideas for sequels. Yeah, we could do that. But don't announce the sequels exactly what they're going to be before you've made one good film. But the thing was, right, so they get rid of Zack Snyder. They get Joss Whedon in. Joss Whedon is now kind of like, you can't go near him. And so what they've done is James Gunn got fired from... From Guardians of the Galaxy, and Suicide Squad have gone, well, that's a bit like Guardians of the Galaxy, isn't it? Let's just get the guy rather than wait for him to rather than hire James Gunn and then wait for him to be publicly shamed later. They've gone, brilliant, he's already publicly shamed, yeah. That's not on us anymore. Mm-hmm. So we'll hire him to do The Suicide Squad, which is basically a semi-sequel, semi-remake, semi-reboot, where some of the characters... I saw the trailer. You go, Rick Flagg is in it. He was literally the worst character in the first one. He's definitely going to get blown up, right? He's definitely dying, right? And then you've got Harley Quinn in it. You go, oh, is she in it? Right, okay, cool. But then you've got Idris Elba, sort of like the main guy in it. Because I don't know. I just think it's like the whole system in Hollywood now is part of the marketing for your big reboot remake is making an original film 2 years earlier that's shit, and then just, you know what I mean? It's just like there are some films that were made that couldn't get sequels, that, you know, in the 80s, yeah. 90s, great films that couldn't get sequels. And now they give full-blown, huge-budget remakes to fourth-tier properties where it's just kind of like, you never heard of The Suicide Squad except for that shit film 2 years ago. Well, guess what? We've made another one.
I mean, yeah, I do. It totally.
And we've mainly learned from some of our mistakes.
I mean, I think it's also like, I mean, on paper, James Gunn is a good choice to do. And it's obviously what they wanted from the beginning.
Yes. Yes.
But it's almost like you've made that mistake already. So it's like, oh, let's just do it the way we wanted to do it anyway.
Well, you've made the shit version of that. Mm. So surely what you do is you go away, you go, what else have we got under DC? They've got everything. They've got everything that they can choose from. What else have we got from DC? And they haven't picked anything. They haven't picked anything relevant. They haven't picked sort of like anything new. It's kind of like...
Yeah, it would have made sense for them more to go, Marvel have got rid of James Gunn. Let's get James Gunn. Let's pitch him and say, what would you like to do at DC, James Gunn?
Unless that's what he did.
And said, I'll do Suicide Squad.
The original Suicide Squad film does not deem a sequel. It doesn't merit a sequel. It's absolutely appalling. Learn from that. The lesson learned from that is don't give your director 6 weeks to write a film.
Hmm. I think the other problem with Suicide Squad...
Don't rush things into production, you know. Try and keep a certain aesthetic between segments of your own franchise, maybe. Or keep it completely disassociated with the rest of the franchise, you know. There's lessons to be learned from Suicide Squad, not, well, we've learned how to not make a Suicide Squad film now, let's make another one.
Given that it's called Suicide Squad, and even if you didn't know anything about what the comics were or what the premise was, I think everyone knew what that film would be and should be. And 20 minutes into the film, you go, wow, they haven't even made the most obvious and correct film from that premise. It's like, why didn't you just have them go on a mission and half of them get killed? It's just they get out. It just feels like it's such an obvious film. And that film is kind of like a fun film that I think even from the title, Suicide Squad, is telling an audience that don't even know about it, oh, I know what that film is. And also the people that do know about it were also expecting that film. And from the trailer, everyone expects a film and they go in to watch it and they deliver something that isn't the film they promised at all. So
but it's exactly, it's the same with Expendables. It's the same thing where the film's called Expendables. And you go, well, they're not all going to make it out alive. Oh, they do. And I couldn't tell you what the plot of the Expendables was, you know. And it's just kind of like you've taken this really simple, basic... All you're doing is you're doing the Dirty Dozen. And you've taken this premise and you can't... It's kind of like... I mean, you say 20 minutes into Suicide Squad. 40 minutes into Suicide Squad, they're still setting it up.
Mm.
They still haven't really gone on their mission yet. It's just a slog. And I say it every single time, but... Con Air is so economic with how it introduces every single one of its characters. You don't spend the film being introduced to characters. You spend the film watching the characters interact with each other and do stuff. Same with Predator. that Predator is even more economic because you introduce all of the characters while they're still on the fucking helicopter. Like, right at the beginning, not the bit when they're listening to Little Richard, but the bit right at the beginning over the opening credits when they all get off. They all get off the helicopter, and the last person on the helicopter is Dutch smoking his cigar, and he gets out, and you meet all of those characters with kind of like a shot or a look to each other, or maybe a line of dialogue here and there. But you know who all those characters are before they get off the helicopter right at the beginning, 5 minutes into the film. And then you watch them getting picked off. The best Suicide Squad movie and the best Expendables movie is the first half of Predator. And then just make that.
And maybe that's it. Maybe if you're James Gunn, you might go, well, what I'm going to do is the film you should have done to begin with. And I could see how that would be quite appealing, because it's almost like, here's what you should have done. If that is what he's done, who knows?
I don't know. Anyway, play a song. Well, we're bang on time. I didn't want to talk about any of that. Let's talk about something else. Well, I hope I die in a slick black limousine. Oh, come along, mama, gonna take a look at me.
Yeah.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're back. Okay, right. So, let's not talk about stuff that we're not fans of. Let's talk about stuff that we are fans of. So, what are you a fan of? What have you been a fan of? That, well, we've just had Easter, haven't we? What did you get? What was Easter like? Did you? Found it weirdly, like we had like I felt like, oh, it's like a break. It felt like it was an actual 4-day break.
Oop.
From nothing.
I just realised I still had a song playing in the background, so I've stopped it.
Oh. Well, this year, more than any other year, felt like a proper Easter, whatever that is.
Which well, a funny way. I do try and mark it a bit and try and have it a bit different Easter. And I think, especially because it was lockdown, you do try and have something. I had a big Maltesers chocolate egg to get through, finished. That's very nice. And I was watching kind of, I mean, it's not really Easter-y, but I found myself watching a bunch of ghost movies. I feel like what I was. Crimson Peak. The Awakening. Oh, yeah. Never seen Crimson Peak.
Hang on. Like Crimson, it, really. Peak, Crimson Peak, The Awakening.
The Awakening was really good. It's like a British
Hang on,
one.
That's not one film. I mean, come on. Crimson Peak, The Awakening, or Crimson Peak?
Oh, Crimson Common. Peak and The Awakening.
Right, okay, sure. Okay.
Crimson Peak is the Guillermo del Toro one.
Yeah, no, I saw it with David Trent at the cinema when we were on tour in 2017. It's terrible.
Yeah, I didn't like it. And yet it's what it's doing is it feels like you're watching it and it feels almost like I do like Guillermo del Toro in general, but a number of his films I really don't get on with. And this is one of them. And I feel like it's referencing all loads of stuff that I really love. And it's like he's going, you know, like those films you like. It feels almost like he's made a film that I should enjoy as well. And I was watching it just going, I find it all a bit like difficult and a bit poorly done. I thought all the, they're really proud of in the, I was watching the extras for it and they're really proud of the CGI ghosts. And I was going, hated them. They're talking about how well they work, and you're going,
actually, didn't work at all. Just from memory, it's like you said, it's like all of those, it's like Hammer Horror, or yeah. It's like a Sherlock Holmes. It's like a period movie, which is great, and it's about, doesn't it start off with kind of them constructing somewhere like Washington? And it's all like dirt roads, and they're like building kind of buildings. And you go, it's Washington, D.C. And you go, oh, I love all of this. And they're all wearing kind of like big dresses and hats with umbrellas. And you go, oh, I love all of this. This is great. And then they go to this spooky mansion. And you go, I love this in theory. Yes. And then, but like the execution is just kind of like, you know, why don't I? It seems a bit, I found it a bit smug.
Yes.
And then she's
introduced, her character's called Miss Cushing. And you go, oh, come on.
It's just like, oh, just fuck off. And so I find it all a bit like that. But then also, it's kind of like, you go, like, it's frustrating because the CGI is so overbearing. I think there's some moments in it where I can barely remember it, but I just remember going like, yeah, that's good. Oh no, yeah. You've gone too far.
Exactly. You keep going, that's a good idea. They've got things like the house, the big sort of spooky house is meant to be sinking into this, where this sort of clay has mixed with something that has created this sort of red colour. And you've got things like the floorboards that feel like they're sinking into blood. It's not blood, but it's got that red, thick ooze coming through. And the walls have this sort of, so it almost looks like the walls are bleeding. But it's explained as like, oh, well, it's sort of built on this sort of clay, which has got mixed with some other red thing, which gives it this weird, oozy. And you go, that's a nice touch. And there's a big hole in the ceiling of the roof, which they've never repaired. So as it goes through, the seasons are changing and you get like sun snow coming through, and then you get like leaves coming through and then snow. And you go, that's a really lovely idea in this film. And if the rest of it was good, it would really add to it. But that's sort of like the highlight, that you've got this nice changing of seasons presented in this house. And it's just, it's just, I don't know, I really, and it's like they're talking about it, how they're trying to do like a sort of gothic Mario Bava type film. And you go, I can see totally what you're trying to do. And I can, and it's like, it's so like, oh, I should like this. It's just that it's so far of the mark of what it's trying to go for.
What's that? Is it Kill Baby Kill?
Yeah, yeah.
It's which is so vivid. It's, I've got it up here. It's it's so sort of like garish and vivid, and yet it's period. Oh, it's, I mean, that is. But what it doesn't have is a fucking CGI ghost. And don't you also feel like by introducing the fact that it's clay, that, and it's not blood, it kind of like takes that sort of. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, it'd be better if it was blood, right?
Yeah.
If the house was bleeding and they couldn't understand why, and then it emerged that it was clay, that's one thing. But to explain it, and then you kind of like go, well, it's not blood. It looks like it, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, when he did Shape of Water, I really loved Kronos. And I really loved Devil's Backbone. Uh-huh. I sort of liked Pan's Labyrinth, but I felt like it was weird. It's sort of like they say, don't go into the labyrinth, and doesn't she go once into the labyrinth, has a bad experience, and then it ends? I think it's kind of like it feels like it's meant to be kind of like a modern fairy tale, and in my mind, the fairy tale should be she kept going into the labyrinth every night. But I think she goes to the labyrinth maybe once and then twice. I don't even think it's like rule of three. I think, it was, you know, and I felt like, oh, it feels a little bit truncated. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm an arsehole here because he's such sort of like a visionary director. But I just don't love it. It's like, so when he did The Shape of Water, it was kind of like, they've updated the Creature from the Black Lagoon costume, makeup.
Yeah.
And you go, that's great. And then it's kind of like they've referenced or outright steal from other films like Splash and Little Mermaid. And you go, okay. And then you have all these people that haven't seen those films that come away and they go, God, this is one of the most original films I've ever seen. And you go, well, no, it's a logical sequel to The Creature from the Black Lagoon. They've caught the creature, and now, do you know what I mean? It's kind of like he's added these elements, but all of the stuff that makes it stand out like that is, like, it's Beauty and the Beast. It's, you know, she doesn't have a voice. It's, I just, and, you know, there are shots for shots where it's kind of like people have side-by-sided them and gone, all right, that's like Splash. And you kind of like go, Splash is a great film.
Yeah.
Creature from the Black Lagoon. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like those Universal. It's all right. I think it's absolutely wonderful to shine a light on those Universal horror movies. And obviously when you look at something like Van Helsing, which is one of the worst films ever made, which was kind of like, hey, we're going to do like a Universal horror movie. And then it's just a CGI shit fest. And you're kind of like, this is nothing like, you know, those films that you say that you love. You've basically stolen some of the aesthetics from it as some sort of lip service, but you've just made another shitty kind of mummy sequel, basically.
And actually, his stuff's much more powerful when it was low budget. And he was, you know, it's that sort of, because he has to work with atmosphere more. And when he's able to suddenly just throw everything at CGI, it's just not very good. I mean, it's things such like a Pacific no-brainer. Rim. Yeah, just to, I could do a really spooky film.
It's such an open. You know, like how Steven Spielberg is the regarded as the greatest living film director. Yeah, and one of the best films ever made has got to be Jaws. Mm-hmm. And the thing that everyone agrees on about Jaws is that not seeing the shark is a benefit to the rest of the film. Mm. Yeah. Like, it's not like a matter of opinion. And it's kind of like, I don't think the shark looks that bad. I've never seen a shark that big to know what it really looks like. Yeah. I've never found the fakeness of the shark that distracting. And in actual fact, some of the shots in Jaws are some of the most chilling shots that I've ever seen. Like, you can't put your feet down on your carpet because it's so... The bit when they're in the lake, which is the bit that's next to the ocean, with the guy in the little dinghy boat, and then the boat gets tipped over and he's in the water, and you just see this overhead shot and this shark opening its mouth just under the water. It doesn't even come out. It doesn't even break the surface of the water. Just see this silent thing float through. And it's one of the most chilling things I've ever seen. And I think Jaws, you know, I'm not the hugest Spielberg fan. He's not my favourite director, but I think Jaws has got to be, if not the best film ever made, one of the best films ever made. It's one of the most effective films ever made. And all of these directors, like Guillermo del Toro, they grew up watching these films. And I understand there must be a bit of pressure from the studio saying, well, you've got to show this stuff. But the lack of lessons learned on how to do it. And then you say that you're a big kind of like Universal horror movie fan. It's kind of like there's part of you when you see something like Hot Fuzz where they're referencing Point Break and Bad Boys 2, and then they have like that doubt in the filmmaking where it's just kind of like, what if our audience hasn't seen Point Break and Bad Boys 2? So let's do a scene in the film where Nick Frost and Simon Pegg are watching Point Break and Bad Boys 2. And not only that, but they're watching the exact clip that we're going to spoof later. And you go, right, okay, so they've done that. So I think that that's a bit heavy-handed, right, for me. But there's got to be a fine line between not giving them any credit, like with Shape of Water, where people come out and they think, well, this is an incredible... It won an Oscar for Best Picture. And you go, well, people would say it's the most original film I've ever seen. And you go, have you not seen the other five films that it's blatantly based on?
I think probably not as well, because it's like for an Oscars-y audience, people go, oh, I wasn't expecting that. And it's like, well, I guess you weren't, because that's you're quite limited by what you're watching, I guess. And you're quite, you've led quite a sheltered viewing. You haven't really gone outside of the prescribed best films that year or whatever. And so maybe that is the case. Maybe that is the case with it. But yeah, it does. It's a shame, really. I mean, I feel a kinship with Guillermo del Toro when interviewed and when he's like obviously Absolutely. Very yeah. much like going on and talking about, he's so enthusiastic and you go, ah, and he's not really like As an interviewee or whatever, talking about these films, he's totally saying, "Oh yeah, it's Creature from the Black Lagoon. I love it, and I love this, and I love that, and I love all these things." And I'm trying to do a Mario Bava film. I'm trying to do a Hammer film. And you're going, "Yeah, yeah, me, oh, I love all this. Let's see what you've done." Then it's just that almost the execution is a bit like, sort of.
The thing is, you could make a Mario Bava film now, and. And just with the fact that, you know, blood looks more realistic.
Yeah.
You can digitally change the colour on. Do you know what I mean? It's like, Mario Bava, what's the Blood and Black Lace?
Hmm.
That's one of the most incredible looking movies. It's basically like 1960s Batman TV series, mm-hmm. only as one of the first ever slasher movies.
Yeah.
And it's set around
it's fashion industry, isn't it?
The fashion industry. And it's got like this faceless killer who looks like the blank out of Dick Tracy. And it's kind of like, there's loads of stuff that's referenced it. And it's just so striking. It's like the lighting is incredible. And the stuff that you take away with it that's memorable is the lighting, it's the camera angles, it's the mood, it's the atmosphere. The stuff that isn't, the stuff that doesn't make it is the CGI, because there isn't any. And it's kind of like, why would you do like a tribute to that stuff and then just whack in a load of, unless, you know, Universal or whoever it is going, well, we've got this massive CGI budget, you're going to have to do all these ghosts.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's it. I guess if you're really doing a tribute to that stuff, you'd try and do it like a low budget film. As I say, I watched this other film, The Awakening, which is like a BBC produced ghost thing. And I was going into it, I was a bit like, I don't want to watch a ghost thing. And you start watching it and you, and straight away you go, all right, yeah, BBC budget. I see this probably isn't going to be very good. And I watch that afterwards and you go, it's much better. It's much better, almost because they've got no money. Much more spooky. Really well done. It's got loads of twists and turns. The ghosts are sort of appearing in a very logical way. They seem to have some sort of form to them, but not quite. It's all like, oh, that. And it's almost that if you're actually trying to make a film like a Mario Bava film or a Hammer Horror film, they were made on low budgets even at the time. You know, they're not, they weren't big budget movies. They were people trying to get create a sort of atmosphere, as did Guillermo del Toro when he was making films in Spain. You know, it's that kind of, that's what he was doing then. When he started out, he's doing ghost movies, which are really spooky, and he's doing them on low budgets.
But would you say, you know, if you had like a big budget, would you light your films with purples and reds and yellows? Or do you think that's because you don't have a budget? So you're trying to make like mundane, like warehouses look interesting.
I think
it's interesting, like, you have this, and I do think there is a lot of studio interference where it's kind of like, well, if you're going to have a ghost, then what does the ghost look like? And it's kind of, oh, it's going to look kind of like this. I also feel like with, that they do have a budget, but they don't really necessarily have quite enough of a budget to pull off what they're, and I think that, I don't know. A ghost, you Nathaniel, could imagine a ghost. And it might absolutely terrify you based on what you've grown up with, what your deep-seated fears are, what your phobias are. You know, you might be able to imagine a ghost and then, but your idea of what is scary is different from what I think is scary, maybe, when you get to the specifics, yeah? But when you get to like the broad strokes of stuff, like something moving out the corner of your eye that you're not sure about, or a huge 25-foot fish that sort of will swallow you, will bite your leg off underneath the surface of the ocean, you know, when you get to like specific, or staring into the ocean, into the deep, dark sea and not knowing what's there, those things are in common with all of us. So in order to get that across, that's where a low budget doesn't really hinder you. You're kind of like getting, the gist across of, you know, stuff moving without you realize, you know, stuff not being where you left it. And, you know, I know when I live alone, and I put something down and I can't find it, and you just, you know, it's like your mind playing tricks on you. You know, it's stuff like that that's kind of like unnerving. It's not seeing a red skeleton floating through a corridor with kind of like tendrils coming off it like a jellyfish. And then you go, ah, that's what it looks like. I've never seen that. I've never seen a ghost come out and look like a ghost. Do you know what I mean? But I know stuff that's sort of like definitely unsettling and unnerving. And I think, I don't know, I guess the more specific you get, the less likely you are of kind of getting your point across, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. It just feels like I don't know. I again, because I do like, I'm on side with him. I'll see his next film, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it's all like, I feel totally on board with it. Just a bit
absolutely.
Like...
Absolutely. I watched a 45-minute documentary online this week about Mimic, and I've never seen it. And I've not seen the Weinstein version, and I've not seen his director's cut, but I was just like, this looks incredible. I can't wait to see it. As I said, I really love Cronenberg. I like his early stuff before he got real popular. Like, very much like the Beatles. All right, here we go. Fishy on a dishy. Hey, fan mail. Hey, nigga nuts. Been catching up on the podcast. I'm on episode 62, August 2009. Wow.
That's a way away.
That's before lockdown, that's for sure. It's my first Friday off work in ages, so I've tuned in to listen to you live. Loving the Coen Brothers chat. Raising Arizona is in my top 10 films. I hope I don't ruin the series for myself by jumping so far ahead. Please, no spoilers, but did Sam Ashurst ever get his recount? Love. Lots of love. Leanne, loads of love, Leanne. No, Sam Ashurst didn't get his recount, but he didn't need one, did he? He got minus 10,000 points, from what I remember.
And you won't find this out for ages, presumably, Leanne.
Unless you go live. And then
yeah, unless you go live, yeah.
Dear Nick, Nathaniel Metcalf, Brian Johnson, Christopher Lee, and possibly Ridley Scott. I'm here. Here you are, Wrigley. I haven't seen Zack Snyder's Justice League yet. Hearing you talk about it put me in mind of Richard Donner's kind of Superman 2. Superman 2 is probably my favorite superhero film.
Or maybe Logan.
But watching the Richard Donner version tonight has made me think this is much better. I wondered what your opinions of it were. Kind regards, Andy Collin. I tell you, I've got the Richard Donner cut. I've had it on DVD when did it come out? 7 years ago? I've had it on DVD for a very long time. It's still in its cellophane. I just don't care.
I'm trying to think whether I watched it. I've got it as well. I don't know that I ever watched it. I was quite happy with it before. I don't think I was ever thinking it was missing anything.
I think one of my problems was I don't love Superman 2. I mean, I've watched Superman 3 since. I probably prefer Superman 3. Can't really remember what happens in Superman 2. Oh, it's
Zod.
All I know is that I would have to probably watch the shit version of Superman 2, or the theatrical version of Superman, the Richard Lester version of Superman 2 first, before I watched the Richard Donner version of Superman 2. And actually, I quite enjoyed that experience watching the original Justice League and the redone Justice League. I enjoyed watching both side by side, and I think it did help. I don't know if I can be bothered to watch Superman 2 and then, while it's still fresh in my mind, watch it again, basically.
Oh, I'm much more fond of Superman 2, but to the point where I don't think I ever had a big issue with bits. I wasn't going, oh, this feels like it's been...
I don't think it's there to fix it. I think it's there to show you an alternative. It's like a companion piece.
Mm.
Whereas I think with Justice League, it's going, this is it. This is the real one. Mm. It's not a companion piece. You're not going to watch Zack Snyder's Justice League and then go back and watch the original and go, it's like a two-hour version. Mm. You know, it's a different film. But with Superman 2, I don't think I care enough, really. And I'd rather watch Superman 3. Or 1. Mm. Or 2. Whatever I'm given. I do own it.
I certainly like Superman 2 a lot. I think it is a really good superhero film. And it kind of is the flip of the first Thor movie, and it is sort of a knockoff of Superman, where he's like loses all his powers and he's on Earth being a mortal version. The first Thor movie I always felt was like, they're just doing Superman 2 with Thor.
Yeah, but then I would rather watch a film. I'd rather watch, I watched The Last Temptation of Christ for the first time this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
For Easter. Have you seen that?
Have I seen it? Yeah. I watched it last Easter, in fact.
Hard going, isn't it?
I liked it. Look, I've got a lot of time for it.
Sure.
That actually has a thing of comedy.
No king of comedy, though, is it?
That email had on the next bit down has a PS.
P.S. What are your thoughts on the prospect of a new Evil Dead film without Bruce Campbell?
Without Bruce Campbell.
They did one without Bruce Campbell.
They've done one without Bruce Campbell. It was fine. I don't rewatch it. It's not the story that keeps me coming back to Evil Dead. It's the jokes, the camera work, the energy, and Bruce Campbell. So you can make you can make an Evil Dead film without Bruce Campbell. Go for it. It's meant to be set in a high rise, isn't it? It's, you know, I think changing it from a cabin is a good start, and doing something different with it is great. Looking forward to it. But I mean, I wish he'd stop being so like curmudgeonly about it and just accept the fact that people love him. You know, it's like it must hurt his knees or something, you know. But yeah, I do see what the point is. I just think that, yeah. Right, I guess he's in the waiting room. Going to play a song and then we'll get him in.
And Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. Live. We're not live. We're pre-recorded. And we're back in the studio. We're not in the studio. I am in my spare room. And Daniel's in his washroom. And we're joined now. Live. We're not live. But we're joined now by comedian, podcaster, comedic historian, and now author, Wayne Federman. Hello. How are you doing?
Swell, thank you. Thanks for having me on this show. It's not live.
Nothing's live. But it's as live. It's as live. Okay. It's as live. Whereabouts on the planet are you right now?
I'm in a city called Los Angeles, specifically an area called Mid-City, which is, you can guess where that is.
Sort of the middle, around the middle?
Bingo.
I'm pretty good at pretty good at geography. I'm pretty good.
I didn't know you were going to be that good.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And it's 7 o'clock in the morning where you are, right?
You betcha. You betcha.
That's great. And I see you've got a drum kit behind you. Is that right?
Yeah. Do you want to guess the brand? Do you know drums?
No, I don't know drums.
Oh, never mind then. Never mind.
Is it a Rhythm Traveler? Is it a Pearl Rhythm Traveler?
It's a DW. No. DW, guys.
It's a DW. And is that your kit?
You betcha. Yep. I used to play drums in high school. When I went to college, or as you call it, university, I gave them up because I didn't want to be like, hey, I'm your roommate. Here are my drums. I didn't want to be that guy. So, but then now that I have like this little garage area, I was like, all right, I'm coming back in. I'm coming back in strong.
This isn't something you took up when lockdown hit or the pandemic hit.
No, like a couple of years before I bought the kit. But I love it. I love it so much. My neighbors, not so much.
Were you ever in bands?
Mm-hmm. My very first gig before I was a comedian, before I was a voiceover artist, before I was an actor, I played a couple weddings with my old drum kit.
Because I was watching some of your early stand-up, and you were playing, you were playing the ukulele on it.
Yes, that was my big closer. That was my big closer.
But so, did you know how to play the ukulele? What came first? Did you know how to play the ukulele before you were doing comedy, or did you work it into your set because you thought I could nail this?
Good question. I guess I was doing comedy before I learned how to play the ukulele, but I've always loved music and comedy. I just loved it. There was a guy named Victor Borga. You don't know who I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I just adored him. And then Steve Martin hit when I was a kid and used to play the banjo. I was like, what's going on? I just love it. And then I will say that some comedians look down on it. They think it's a bit of a cheat. So I just want you to know that is a real thing in the comedy world.
Mm-hmm. I am a musical comedian. I have a guitar behind me. Yeah. I've got a guitar behind me. You've got a drum kit behind you. We can all pretend.
What kind of guitar? I mean, I see it's green, but what kind is that?
I can't remember. What is it? It's I bought this because my my guitar, the pickup in my guitar broke when I was just about to go on stage, and my costume was blue. So I bought a blue guitar, and I actually don't like this one very much.
Let's not talk about it. If it's going to bring up bad memories, I don't want it to.
Well, the fretboard's really small, and if it's got wide frets, you can sort of like mash your fingers on the fretboard and sort of approximate a chord and get somewhere. But if it's
right. Yeah.
Yes. So Nathaniel's a comedian as well, but I am a comedian that uses music. So,
right. I don't know anything about Nathaniel. What does he do?
Well, I don't play a guitar because I don't like to cheat. But actually, I would say I know exactly what you mean. There is an idea, isn't there? There is an idea that maybe if you've got something else going on, there's some sort of cheat to it, and there is some. I guess more sense of authenticity. I don't think there is really by just being a man and a mic, or woman and a mic.
Right.
But I think that's part of the interesting thing about your book, which is the history of stand-up from Mark Twain to Dave Chappelle. And it's sort of about what is and isn't stand-up, right? And your definition seems to be virtually anyone who is on stage trying to elicit a laugh.
One person, yes, that's kind of my general definition of it. But I do lean towards the people who are just standing there by themselves. Only their voice, only the microphone, only the obligatory brick wall, and a bunch of people judging them.
It's sort of from the tradition begins with, as it says, from Mark Twain, who I kind of think of as like a humorist, but it is interesting that you go, I guess that is, if you're going on tour and speaking in front of an audience for laughs, you're a comic, right? You're a stand-up comic.
Obviously, the word stand-up didn't become invented until 1947, so he lived many years, and was dead many years before that term, but he was definitely doing something that we later thought of as stand-up. So, yeah, and it goes, if you... In the book, I even go back pre the guy who inspired Mark Twain is in the book. But I just, first of all, I'm fascinated that you're into the book because the book is primarily about the United States. There's, I mean, I mentioned Hannah Gadsby. I mentioned James Acaster. There's a few I mention because it's a worldwide situation now. And, but so how, why are you that interested in the book over there?
Well, because it is all sort of the same thing. But I think that's part of the interesting thing about the book is that you can see how there's certain dovetailing and a lot of things are happening at different times, which I think I've assumed before reading the book that it was all happening simultaneously. But it was all like, no, at that point we were doing this. And at this point, so you right. have things like vaudeville. And in my mind, vaudeville is something that's happening the same time as music hall over here.
Yep. Yep.
And it's not really. It's sort of a bit, there's a bit of overlap. But
I think music hall, if my understanding is music hall predates vaudeville,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
What do you really think music hall?
I think Victorian era music hall. And music hall is very kind of working class. And vaudeville struck me in your book is it's quite middle class, right? It's quite a kind of sort of very kind of family friendly.
Well, that's what they were trying. That's what they were going for. Are you telling me in music hall? Because now I'm turning this whole thing and asking you questions now. Mm-hmm. In music hall,
I'll write a book.
There was, you write a book. You can come on my podcast. Here, my question is, in music hall, there were no kids allowed at music hall?
Well, music hall's a bit more, it's very, a lot of the comedy on it is very double entendre based. And it's kind of, but it was sort of seen as, it was certainly working class music hall. And I think, I mean, maybe the double entendre made it be able to get away with more because they're not exactly being explicit.
That was the point of the double entendre, though, wasn't it? It was so get away with saying stuff in public that you couldn't get away with saying overtly.
Are you guys familiar with ukulele player George Formby?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm surprised you are.
No. I'm a ukulele guy. Come on. I've been to the ukulele festival of Great Britain. I performed.
But in terms of stand-up comedy and comedy, I think American comedy gets absorbed into British culture.
Yeah.
More because America is huge and it's kind of the dominant force. Like when I was growing up, it was all kind of literally Steve Martin videos in the video shop every week. And I watched Steve Martin do stand-up before I saw pretty much anyone else do stand-up. And Robin Williams, I mean, I was too young for Robin Williams because there's so much swearing. But American stand-up was a big part of kind of like growing up.
Well, we're thrilled. We're thrilled to be part of it. Obviously, it's so interesting. I'm still into musical comedians. So, I don't know what that sound was. That's not me.
My
is
microphone.
It?
It's just my microphone.
Okay, it's no big deal.
It's fine.
Was Tim Minchin?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm enjoying his stuff for years. Actually, I saw him live over here a couple times when he came to the United States.
Although you played ukulele.
I did. And now I've switched to piano.
Oh, because I was literally just going to say, I think a lot of the reason why people use ukuleles is because they're so small. And I mean, I stopped taking my guitar anywhere and I started using click tracks.
You did? Okay.
Because it was just easier than lugging stuff around everywhere. And I guess that's why people use the ukulele. But now you use a piano.
Yeah, I needed something a little smaller than a uke, so I went grand piano.
But presumably you don't have to push those around with you on trains or in your car.
They're usually at the venue. That's part of the thing. But sometimes they have to do the electronic keyboard, which is annoying.
Sure, and I guess it doesn't have the appeal or the look of a grand piano, which is certainly more showbiz, right?
Yes. I don't see Tim Minchin playing a Roland keyboard. Come on. It's humiliating.
How do you feel about do you consider yourself to be a musical comedian or I would say
of my act it's 70% stand up, 30 let's do it, it's even more. It's like 80% stand up, 20% music with stand up. But I don't do whole songs like Tim mentioned. I just do like a little thing and then get in, then get out, get a laugh. It's just silly.
One of the things I liked about the book, it sort of feels that it was quite objective, what I thought was really interesting, that it feels like you weren't, it almost struck me that the impression I get is that you like everything, is that it didn't feel like you
great,
were.
First of all, this is a great question. That's a great question. And my whole point was this, was that so many people write books about comedy like, this comedy doesn't age well, or this comedian seems out of date or seems inappropriate. It's like, that's not what this book is about. My book is like, they were funny at that time for those people, and that's enough for me to include their contribution, whether I think they're, and a lot of comedy doesn't age well. That is the great secret of stand-up, that it doesn't, the comics you like as a kid, like you're going to like them their whole lives, but kids younger than you may not even like them or even think they're funny. Like, it's so weird. It's such a generational art form, but great observation. Yes, that was my point. So it changes. I mean, it's constantly changing.
And it felt like you're talking about older acts and acts that predate you, contemporaries of yours, and much newer comics. But it's written in a way which is, it's all sort of, it's all the same thing. And that was a nice thing for me reading it now, because I find it difficult. There's a pandemic on and I'm not performing.
Right.
And I also feel like having this time off, I don't know how much, you find yourself going, well, will I do something else or will I go back to doing it? I don't know. But actually it's really nice for me reading it, because it feels that you're reading it and you feel like you're part of a tradition. In the same way that if I'm lucky enough to play a big theatre, I'll always go, well, who else has performed here? And, you know, it's in every theatre in this country probably was a music hall or is hundreds of years old. So you probably start Googling who else has been on that stage. And, you know, you've got that nice thing where you can be on a stage and you go, oh, Chaplin was here or Louis Armstrong was here or something.
Right.
And you have those. And I find that, there's a real romantic side to doing comedy. And
I hope that came through in my book as well.
And I had that
same romantic history book, guys.
Yeah. But there is, right? Do you have that? Are you a nostalgist in that way?
I'm not a nostalgist, but I'm not a generationalist, a word I just came up with. because I look at the whole thing as one continuous story that, okay, this is the way, let me see if this hits you at all. I always look at stand-up comedy as a huge metaphorical swimming pool, okay? And at the shallow end is just a madhouse. There's thousands of people trying to get in. Some people are just dipping their toe in. They like emceeing something or doing an open mic. I don't know what that term is. And it's just, you can't even know if you know how to swim, because it's just, the water's everywhere. People are kicking you. You don't know what's going on. But then as you get a little deeper and the pool gets a little deeper, you notice some people are like, oh, they're actually swimming. They're actually getting laughs and doing jokes. And then you get even deeper and like, oh, look, these guys are like headlining clubs and headlining theaters or opening for someone who's like a headliner. And they're like, they're really swimming. They're in it. They're doing it. And they're past that crazy point. And then at the far end, the deep end, there's like a diving board and these, you know, that's where the top acts are. They're doing backflips. People are cheering. They're throwing money at them. They're getting laid whenever they want to. It's like a dream. So it's like, it's just craziness there. And so this pool is always going, always people are trying to move to the deep end of the pool. Some just are like, I hate the water. I got to get, I'm just going to be a writer. I can't deal with any of this. And then, but my point is that no matter if you're at the deepest end of the pool with Dave Chappelle and Mulaney and Bill Burr, or at the shallowest open mic guy, everyone in the pool is doing the same thing. You're all in the same pool. You might not even be making money. So it's like, and the thing is, if you quit, you got to get out of the pool. If you die, got to get out of the pool. You can't have like Bob Hope's body floating around. It's going to freak out the people, right? So that's the way I look at it. I look at it, we're all doing this together. And I've seen with these eyes, these very eyes, comedians go from the shallowest end to the deepest, to the diving board. Like, I've seen it. So it just happens. And then each, like, when you get in the pool, there's people in the pool. But by the time you're done your career, there's going to be almost a whole new group of people swimming, you know, if you're lucky and you last like a whole, you know, you do it for a whole time. So it's, the pool keeps getting replenished. So I don't care if it's Mort Saul or Lenny Bruce or, you know, Jack Benny, or, you know, today there's a bunch of, I mean, there's so many great comics today. It's stunning to me how good they are.
One of the clips I watched on YouTube of you was a clip of you speaking to Bob Hope. And I had that where you were kind of, yeah. It was a show from the late 70s, right? And you were very young.
Yep. You looked
about 14.
Are you particularly ashamed of all of your content on YouTube?
No, I'm not. Obviously, I put it up. So it's like, I'm not ashamed, but it's just, you know, that's the earliest video of me engaged in comedy in any way.
But I just thought it was interesting that you've written this book, which is about the history of stand up, and you've got a clip which is 40 seconds of you chatting to and gently ribbing a comic legend who, for me, is someone who you think, oh, that's from the late 70s. I don't know what year Bob Hope died, actually. Mid 80s, later than that, was it?
It into the 90s.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just thinks, and you think, well, his career as well. And there is a point where you, when you go to meet, you shake hands, and it does have that funny sense of like, oh, I'm writing a book one day. I'm going to write a book in
that. That's awesome.
I don't think it's across generations almost.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was so nervous. And whenever I look at that clip, I just see like I'm completely just kind of shit. My voice doesn't even sound. The whole thing is uncomfortable to watch. But it is amazing that there is footage of that. And I remember I remember that day. Yeah.
Was that actually footage of you meeting him, or had you met him before backstage?
Nope. Oh, no. I was an audience member. He was on a chat show, kind of, and he would go out into the audience and take questions from the audience. So immediately I stood up with the question.
Wow.
So at that point, were you doing stand-up, or was that before you were even doing stand-up?
Well, it depends on where – I don't count that. I count that as pre-stand-up. Wayne Fetterman history, because I was at college at that time. I was at New York University. But at school, I was doing shows. So do you count that?
Yeah. At school, at what age?
I was like 19.
I think you count that.
Oh, well, then I've been doing comedy for a very long time. Do you count if you do plays? I count the when I started getting paid to do stand-up as like the start of it for me.
Well, it depends if you're counting, if you're considering yourself comedy or stand-up. I wrote my first Edinburgh when I was 20.
Wow.
But I didn't do stand-up until I was 26, 27.
Right.
So as a stand-up, I can't say that I was a stand-up since I was 20, but I was writing comedy from the age of 20.
Nick, can I ask you a question about that? Because I'm super curious about these hour-long Edinburgh shows. Is that how long yours was?
It was a collection of plays, the first
Okay.
And then it was stand-up in 2007.
Yeah, but I feel like there's a real unbelievable tradition of in Australia there of writing these 1-hour, a new 1-hour performance. Yeah. every year or every couple of years, and that's just expected.
That was. I think that's a big difference between American and British mm-hmm. comedians. I don't know about anywhere else, but I know that when Jerry Seinfeld did that show where he burnt all of his books, and he buried his books, didn't he? He had that yeah. sketch at the beginning, and he goes, "This is the last time I'm doing it." And then he did a film where he had to work up a new hour. And I know that, because I think we were all like magpies when we were starting doing comedy. So we'd all watch that documentary Comedian and we're like, oh, right. And I think we were all like scratching our head, kind of like, what's the big deal? He's writing another hour of comedy, because it's sort of built into your, it's like a school year where, you know, Edinburgh's in August, so that's like your exams. And then in September you start again and then you build up to your exams again every year. And some years, and then for the rest of the year, you sort of cannibalize your set. So you'll have 5 minutes for the radio and 5 minutes for some TV, mm-hmm. And then you'll build up another hour again. Whereas comedians, kind of American comedians, is this right? You have like an hour, and then you kind of like tour it.
Yes, that's the way. But I mean, there was a few comedians, George Carlin in particular, who kind of wrote a new hour every couple of years. I don't know anyone, maybe Louis C.K. in his prime, that was doing a new hour a year, you know, Great Britain style.
Also, you say tradition, and it is a tradition now, and I think of it very much a tradition in the time I've doing it, but that tradition mm-hmm. probably started in like 1990 or something. You know, it's not like something that feels like, and that's the other thing in your book where you're talking about kind of alternative comedy is starting
yes.
in the 90s.
I know it started earlier there, right?
Yeah, but what we would call alternative comedy then, and now to an extent, was British comedians copying American comedians. So I think what's interesting about your book, when you're talking about the Richard Pryor movie, we yep. got that here in the late 70s. And that generation of comics, even they probably weren't comics then, became comics. That's like a sort of almost
so
like
that
punk
movie
moment,
had an international,
you know?
international
release. So there would be lots of people who became almost the first generation of alternative comedians. Here, we would have had, you know, I guess comedy post musical and variety. I guess you mm-hmm. would have in the 60s, and you'd also have stand-ups that were like kind of front of curtain people for, I guess, more like, so here you had things like, there was a famous theatre in the West End called the Windmill. I know mm-hmm. a lot of sort of British comedians of the 50s and 60s started at, and they would have like these sort of tableaus that were basically nudes, but they weren't allowed to move on stage. So it's basically dirty old men would go and watch. So almost wow, like watching a stripper or something, but stripping would be like illegal, but a tableau was seen as arty.
Right. I know they did tableaus in Ziegfeld Follies. They had that where the girl could stand but not move.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Same thing. So they would change the tableaus, and when the curtain would drop and they would change whatever the girls were doing behind the curtain, you would have essentially an MC would come out who would be a comic in front of the curtain while they're changing the backdrop and doing gags. So there's lots of people right. in the 60s here who started, and they were probably more like traditional stand-ups, but they were probably doing jokes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. So when you say alternative, the new comedians were alternative to that?
Yeah, but also more of an alternative. There was more, so you'd have working men's club comics.
So, yeah, we had like working men's comics where we'd have a lot of northern comedians like Bernard Manning, who would kind mm-hmm. of like do lots of racist material and okay. sexist material, and then sort of alternative comedy was like an alternative to kind of you know, racist sexist stuff that was more kind of and it was less traditional. It was kind of like less, even down to wearing suits and ties and going on stage and looking your best and coming out, and now I'm going to entertain you. It was kind of like people oh. wore T-shirts and stuff. But also the invention of VHS and video must have changed everything. Because I remember the very first Comic Relief in 1986 or 1987, and they showed a clip of Eddie Murphy from Delirious doing uh-huh. the ice cream yep. routine.
Yep. Yep.
And that must have been one of the first bits of stand-up that I ever saw. And then with VHS...
I write about that special in the book. In the book, yeah, yeah. It's
Delirious.
Yeah, Delirious but is then, the special, yeah, yeah.
But then with the invention of VHS, what you have is you have all of sort of like our most mainstream comedians. We had like Jack D and Joe Brand and Lee Evans and Eddie Izzard, and they would bring out a Christmas video every year of a, you know, an hour of stand-up. And then it became kind of like, oh, this is a marketable thing. But they weren't releasing films like Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy that you could see at the cinema. They were things that you could just buy in the petrol station.
Right.
Or Woolworths. And then and you'd buy them every year and you'd watch a new hour of comedy. So it was kind
okay,
of
let
like
me ask you, I'm very
culture.
Curious about all of this, obviously. With that new hour, let's say the new Eddie Izzard hour that came out in Christmas on a VHS. Uh-huh. Was there also a companion CD or cassette that came with it, or was it on the radio, or was it?
They would probably have a release of it on a CD. You could probably buy it as a CD as well,
but it'd be separate.
Yeah, of course.
But it would be off. It would be off the back of a tour. It was. I think it was all part of. I think
a promotion?
It was Open Mic. I think they were all with a company called Open Mic, and which was Jack D's company, I think. And they would tour, and they would go all around the country, and there were less comedians back then, I think. And they'd go all around the country and they'd finish off at the London Palladium and they'd tape it and they'd release it. And then they'd start a new show and then it would build up to them recording it again so that you could get the maximum amount of money out of every kind of joke that you'd written.
That's incredible. Maybe you should write a story, the history of British stand-up.
Well, reading your book, it feels like it's very interesting how it kind of intersects and things. But yeah, it's that alternative thing in the States feels like. So now all comedy really here is what they would have called alternative comedy in 1980, because you don't have that kind of traditional comedy at all anymore. It's kind of gone.
You're talking about in Britain?
In Britain.
There's not one who does that old school.
Oh, they kind of do, I
There's
think.
There's got to be somebody that's doing it, right?
I guess.
But it's probably generally less seen on the same circuit. And if they do it, it's sort of either ironic or a deliberate throwback rather than, oh, this is just the way I do it. It's kind of thought through.
Well, I saw a British comedian come to the United States in the late 70s, early 80s, called Bruce Forsyth. Mm-hmm. You know that guy.
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah.
Now, how does he fit into that world? Does he
would
bridge
have been windmill.
Two?
Well, I've read Bruce Forsyth's autobiography, and he was one of the windmill acts. So he was one of those guys who did the front of curtain tableau.
Yeah.
And then, but over here, he's more like, he was a comic, but over here, and where he kind of, how he got famous was he basically hosted game shows.
Yeah.
And, talk show and things.
He started off as an actor, didn't he? In the 50s, 60s, he did Black and White comedies
for the Disney movie.
Oh, right. Yes.
And then he became kind of like the old guard. I mean, he died quite recently, didn't he? And so during lockdown, I've been watching old game shows, and so I've been watching. What did he do? He did Play Your Cards Right.
Yeah.
And Take Your Pick.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
It almost sounds like you're making up the name of a game show with those two.
But that's sort of how it was, because they were sort of just vehicles for Bruce Forsyth to talk to members of the general public.
How fast was he? Like, how would you compare him to, like, I don't know, you know, I see James a lot. I'm trying to think of the guy who's does the kind of offensive one-liners. He's all over the place as a comic. Am I blanking on his name?
British?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Jimmy Carr.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. I've done shows with him. So but how would you without being judgmental, how would you compare Forsyth's ability to banter with the crowd and mine material out of interviews with like someone like Jimmy Carr?
Well, weirdly, Jimmy Carr now is kind of isn't that dissimilar from Bruce Forsyth here, you know.
Interesting.
But Bruce Forsyth as well wouldn't be he wouldn't be part of that working men's club, because again, that's a very working class thing. He was kind of top of the bill. He hosted Sunday Night London Palladium. So he's probably more of the tradition of like Morecambe and Wise. Do you know that? Mm-hmm. Morecambe and Wise or the two Ronnies?
Of course.
And I know both probably, so those guys would be, they might well have started in working men's clubs, but mm-hmm. they would have, in the 60s, would have been kind of top of the bill variety acts. So they're not playing clubs, they're playing theaters. You know, they're
right.
not.
I mean, you see those guys whenever you see like early Beatles stuff, the Beatles would show up on these variety shows.
So like, Bruce Forsyth would be one of those guys. He'd be top of the bill.
Gotcha.
So he was of a different standing than a lot of the.
But he, up until his death, mm-hmm. was always on the number one. Like, so he did the Generation Game in the 90s, which was the peak, like, Saturday night mainstream entertainment. And right. then all the way up to when he died, which was he was doing Strictly Come Dancing, because yep. he was a bit of a dancer as well. Yep. So he did Strictly Come Dancing, which was, you know, my mum never even liked Bruce Forsyth, but every Saturday night she watched Bruce Forsyth on Strictly Come Dancing. You know, he was up until, well, for like how many years is that? Like 50, 60 years?
Yeah, 50.
He was at the top of, he was at the peak of what it was capable of doing mm-hmm. as a mainstream entertainer in Britain, really.
Well, I saw him on Broadway at the Winter Garden Theater. So we can look up whenever that date was. I don't know what, if he was transitioning from that, but this men, what are you calling it? Men's club? What do you call it?
Working men's club. They would be sort of small clubs that probably hold, what, 100, 150 yeah. people? And they're one in every town. One in every town. And you would be like...
It's like blue collar.
Blue collar.
And was it mainly men in the crowd? Was it mainly just men?
You could sign in your wives, I think, if you wanted to. You could sign them in.
That sounds like a tough gig.
It would be a carded thing. It would be a club.
Yeah.
You could probably bring your wife. And it might even be some of those clubs would probably have ladies' rooms where they would sit together and you'd have the men in one room. But you'd probably go out and watch.
That sounds tough because as my experience doing stand-up all these years is if there's too many guys in the crowd, it's not a good show. That's always been my experience.
From what you understand, those clubs were very tough rooms to play. There's a very
maybe that's why they were kind of maybe a little more racist, yeah. a little more like they were like, okay, we got to hit, yeah,
yeah. I'm sure that's.
You think your act could translate to that, or are you too sensitive?
My act, no, absolutely not, absolutely not. I wouldn't like to test it.
What about you, Nick?
I've got quite an aggressive,
sweary
act, and I've been in quite hostile environments, and it doesn't work because I'm already hostile, so I've got nowhere to go. It only really works when you're kind of in a gentle situation.
Yeah,
yeah. People that read The Guardian over here that are kind of like very docile. And I've had a lovely evening, and then I come out and I ruin it. But I've had sort of aggressive audiences, and it's always ended with kind of like, yeah, everyone wanting to fight. So
I have another question for you guys. How big is the scene now in stand-up in England? I mean, obviously, I know we're in the middle of a pandemic, but like right before it happened. Because it just seemed like it was exploding from my point.
Oh, same here, I'd say. It's just getting bigger and bigger. I think also Nick and I are probably the last generation. And we started 2007, so it's not that long ago in mm-hmm. in dog years, you know.
Right.
2006, 2007. Except I think we're probably the last generation of people who started not expecting to earn any money from it. Whereas I feel like there's... The generation that seems to have come along since feel much more, I guess they've seen Russell Brand or someone and seen them go, oh, well, you can now play arenas. Whereas I think Nick and I and the sort of generation that we're in, we're doing it much more out of, not to say people aren't doing it because they love it, but more that I think none of us would have expected much from it.
Right.
I think it became more of a business. So I think when we started in 2007, after a gig, you'd go for a drink. And mm-hmm. if you did Edinburgh, you'd stay out every night and you'd do right. your show. But it would be part of the appeal would be kind of like the socializing. And then a few years into that, there were less and less people out drinking and more people that were kind of like, I've got to get up tomorrow to do my show. And then I think it's moved a lot that way now.
Is there can I piggyback on that a little? Is it also like comedians are like, oh, I have to now tweet and this about that show to sort of help market myself?
Well, yeah, because I think iPhones were just becoming mm-hmm. iPhones revolutionized comedy, because not only could you film your gigs, you could record your gigs. It would help writing your gigs. You could make notes in your phone, and it's kind of, but they were literally either the new software or just about to become kind of like popular. So in 2007, 2008, people really didn't have, if someone had an iPhone, it would be like, oh, you got an iPhone. So, I mean, things like that, technological changes have changed everything. And with Twitter, yeah, it's become a lot more kind of, I guess it's great because everyone is sort of selling them. I was talking to someone in the week and it's like comedy yeah. is a difficult, competitive industry, because it's not like you're selling ice cream and someone over there prefers someone else's ice cream and you work for the ice cream company. It's like right. you're selling yourself. And if someone else, if somebody doesn't like you, they don't like you. They prefer someone else, you know, it's brutal. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's so Twitter helps with all of that stuff.
Well, that's yes. I think that's my take on like watching this generation is the branding part of it is like they're way more sophisticated than I could ever be.
Yeah.
But yeah, you guys are like right on the cusp of the digital age there. If you started in 2006, because that's when it really changed in a huge way.
I feel like it was when I started, it was the end of one thing. You could feel it was like the end of one thing and the beginning right. of another thing, where people could not just make a living, but actually become kind of like super, you know, a superstar based right. on it, which was sort of, we had like five comedians in England for about 15 years. And then all of a sudden it was like, wow, you know. There were so many comedians now. I mean, when did you do your first gig, and how have you noticed the change from then?
I've noticed a lot of different changes, but I think the point of my book is that like no matter what, things change. The technology, there's Twitter, there's Instagram is very popular over here now. There's, but it's still the basic job on stage hasn't changed much until. Recently, when there's comedians that don't even go on stage and just talk right into their phones and do their act or do something and then write something underneath, and that's how they do it. So, you know, I don't know how that will manifest itself, but I think that, I mean, obviously anyone who's done stand up, myself included, we're all in the same pool, like that juice of being on stage and the crowd and you're interacting with the crowd and crowd is loving you and you're back and forth, or they're loving the comic before you and hating you, whatever it is, it's like a real palpable experience for both the comic and the audience. So that hasn't changed since Mark Twain. I mean, that is not, I mean, yes, we have microphones that changed it. You could now, I don't know, Nick, it sounds like you're a very aggressive comedian, but the microphone created something where you could create what I call conversational intimacy with the crowd. So you could even be talking soft and still be loud. They could still hear you in the back, which there was no comedian before that. Like Mark Twain couldn't whisper a punchline and expect to get a laugh because no, it wouldn't go past the third row. So that changed sort of the way people did it. And I don't know. It's, yeah, there's been a lot of changes. There was
one of the interesting things in your book is how far up to date it goes. So you go into pandemic times, you know.
Right. I mentioned the two of you and this actual Zoom meeting. It's incredible.
But that's it. Does it's feel
amazing.
Like, but almost that's what I was thinking. You, like when I was reading it, it's like you could almost do a follow up book, which is the British side of it or something.
It's
parallel. It's just so kind of, I can see things and go, oh, well, that's interesting. That's from there.
My goal is I hope that somebody who's closer to the ground in the British scene could write that book in that style of like the non-judgmental, not like, oh, if you were doing shows in the men's club arena or whatever it's called, you sucked and because you were doing racist stuff and now we're way more enlightened. But just like tell the story, like how this developed and why, and especially I think that the inflection point, which I may have this totally wrong, but is like, oh, your alternative comedy was like, hey, guess what? We're going to try it a different way. And you guys gained an audience doing that. Mm. I guess a little before your time, but I assume all those comedians influenced you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Of that 80s, 90s.
Yeah. Era. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But it's sort of like, it's like music, isn't it? Where, you know, the Beatles, Elvis influenced the Beatles and the Beatles influenced, you know, and it's kind of like, exactly what I just said.
You can say it again. You can repeat yourself if you need to.
I was just gonna repeat myself again. But it's like you have so many American comedians that reference people like Monty Python.
Yes, as big
influences on them. Who were we talking to the other week? We were talking to Michael J. White the other week, who's a martial arts actor. And he was saying Monty Python is a huge influence on him. And it's kind of like, yeah, great. I'm not sure how much Monty Python is an influence on me. But but I'm sure that Monty Python must have been some sort of influence on Steve Martin. Hmm. And Steve
a
Martin.
A little bit. A little bit. I think Steve Martin was more. There was a guy I write about in this book named Wally Bogue, who was a big influence on Steve Martin. And Steve Martin just had an idea of like, I'm going to do comedy and a little different than what's happening right now. And this is either going to work or it's not. And then it's obviously it blew up in a huge way. But I'm trying to think. Well, anyway, go ahead.
I guess Monty Python here is an influence on all that generation too, but they're not stand-ups. They're from a sort of more university. So you have things like the Footlights and things who are like more kind of sketch groups, but that's sort of slightly different from stand-up as well. Now I think you probably have, crossover of people who are in sketch groups who also do stand-up.
But
Monty Python weren't that. They were more of that tradition. So I guess they're more in the tradition of like Dudley
Moore
and
was
Peter Cook.
Like half that group's from Cambridge, the other's from Oxford, right? Isn't it like,
And you have, Beyond the Fringe, those guys.
Oh, I love that. Well, again, that guy, Dudley Moore, was like, that's what I would love to do with my piano on stage. Not the Roland keyboard, but the piano. The way he did it was incredible. I feel like that's almost the start of the British invasion, if you ask me, for the United States, was when they came over and they were on Broadway. And then they were like, oh, we're into these guys. And then...
But then, they were cool
2 years before,
and young as well.
Young, cool, like, and then, and then the United States went Britain crazy at that time. I mean, it peaked with the Beatles, but then My Fair Lady and, like, The Sound of Music, you know what I mean? Julie Andrews, and, like, we were just England nuts at that time. Mm-hmm. There was a movie that won the Best Picture of 1963 called Tom Jones. Mm-hmm. Which is, I don't even know if you know that movie, but it's like, oh, this is British. We love it. We, you know.
But I guess the Beatles coming out, the Beatles are part of that kind of variety scene, are all big kind of, like, if you look at Hard Day's Night or any of that stuff on, you know, the Ed Sullivan Show, that's them doing comedy. They're like, they're funny people.
Just like
they're like the Marx Brothers or something. They've got this sort of, that they are, you know, they're watching those movies and being influenced by stuff like that, you know.
John, I know, loved the Goons and Spike and all of those guys, right?
Yeah. So, again...
But they also had... But Wilfred... Wilfred... What's his name? Wilfred Bramble?
Wilfred Bramble?
Yeah.
Wilfred Brambrough from Steptoe and Son. He was, that was like a huge British sitcom, which became Sanford and Sons in America.
Yep.
So, he was in A Hard Day's Night.
And
A Hard Day's Night is all about them making a TV appearance where there's kind of like jugglers and women in flashy dresses that are also kind of like in the TV studio. And they're part of a variety show. I mean, that's what the film's about.
Well, if you even think about what the Ed Sullivan Show was, I write about it a lot in the book. That was an old school vaudeville variety show. I mean, it was like the Beatles, and then there was like a comic on that show, and then there was a juggler, and then the Beatles came back. And so that they were definitely that. My favorite thing about the Beatles is they never did a live performance where they weren't all wearing the same outfit.
That makes sense, I guess. Yeah.
Think about that. Like, they're all putting on their uniforms to go do their shows. That's incredible. I mean, except for that rooftop concert, but I don't count that. That wasn't a paid thing.
Because I guess they're part of that. I mean, they kind of change things, but they are part of an older showbiz world, and they're entering it as even the haircuts are sort of like part of the uniform, right? At the start,
Like you never saw the Rolling Stones all wearing the same outfits. Or maybe at the beginning you did. I don't know exactly. But certain, so they were like, that might be some Brian Epstein marketing situation.
Yeah, maybe. I guess, they had their time when they're all in the kind of, they've got the quiffs and but I guess they.
The suits and the jackets. So do you guys get tired of talking about the Beatles as British people?
We do actually mention. We actually mention them every week.
Yeah, that's what I assume.
It's interesting.
We can move on. Yeah. We can move on.
Well, I always think they're a band that you sometimes get people that go, "Hey, I don't even like the Beatles."
It's not an
argument that washes. Do you know what I mean? You go, "What do you not like about them?" And then they end up going, "No, they're really good, aren't they?" Because he can't. It's not really a pointless argument to make because it's just not true. It's an incorrect opinion.
Yes, but I like the early Beatles when they did cover versions.
The Hamburg Beatles.
Nathaniel Knight is the old Beatles when they were all experimental, right? So
I like both.
Sure. But I like them before they were famous, right?
No, I do know some people who are like, they only like them before they get on that Pan Am flight to come to America in February 90s. They're like, that's the end of it for me. I was like, wow, that's an incredible Beatle fan.
I think part of the thing that we haven't really talked about is I think all British comedians are much more influenced by American comedians probably than their own history, of comedy, that's how it feels. And it certainly feels now. I mean,
I have to say that your buddy James Acaster is really making a really big indent with that repertoire situation, which I assume he repurposed old hours into this new.
I think they were three Edinburgh hours. They were always designed to be linked. I'm in the first one briefly.
What?
I'm in it.
Oh my God.
I'm in the last bit where he has one of them. I don't know if it's the first one. I'm in a bit where they've.
Like me with Bob Hope.
Yeah, I'm like Bob Hope. there's a bit
you
where
you get
he's got,
any. Okay, I just again.
I'm not
curious.
Really in it. But no, like, I mean, my voice is in it, in the bit where he's got like a podcast thing.
Okay. Do you get any royalties from that at all?
No. And I signed it away because I was in it anyway. And then there was a thing where they said, oh, can you do a thing for Netflix? Can you sign a thing to say your voice will be in it? And I thought, yeah, okay. And I was paid the contract said £1. And I never got the pound. Happy to be in. Never got the pound. They could at least give me free Netflix. That's what I think.
I would think so. I'll look into that. Yeah, but anyway, that four show arc, which is, apparently it's all about you. I didn't know that. Apparently,
yeah, yeah. It's mainly me, I think.
Yeah, that's what I heard. That's getting a lot of traction over here. Is like, oh, he's like kind of raising the bar a little bit. On even trying something like that.
Do you think I could tour America off the back of my
the voice on the thing?
Yeah. I could put it on a poster.
Of course.
Right, I'll be on the next flight. I'll be on the next flight, which will probably be in about a year.
Oh no. Come on, guys. We're gonna do this.
We're running out of time.
Okay.
So we're going to once more plug your book, The History of Stand-Up, from Mark Twain to Dave Chappelle. It was released on March the 15th, and it's available everywhere now. And now, Wayne, I'm going to hand you back over to Nathaniel to play our internationally renowned game, Better or Worse.
Okay, this is the game, Wayne. Just have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my opinion to score points.
Of course.
Beginning with Kevin
Bacon. It's scientific.
Scientific, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Kevin Bacon. But is Kevin Costner better or worse than Kevin Bacon?
Better. I hate these kind of games because I feel like I'm going to hurt somebody's feelings. But I'm going to go better.
Daniel's opinion.
Better.
Because he won an Oscar for directing Dances with Wolves.
Yeah. Ozzy Osbourne, better or worse than Kevin Costner?
Worse. Oh, I see. What's that? Oh, so you're piggybacking. That's a hard one. I'd like Ozzy. I'd like it. Okay. Worse. I'm going to go Ozzy's better.
He's worse. No. Sharon Osbourne, better or worse than Ozzy Osbourne?
Worse.
Okay. I feel like Nick is giving me all the answers here.
I could be just as wrong as him. But I
feel like you guys started around the same time. You're from the same generation.
Are we going to have to rattle through this?
I'm going to piggyback Nick and go worse.
Worse. Sharon Stone, better or worse than Sharon Osbourne?
Well, that's better, obviously. That's not even hard.
Oliver Stone.
It's not even difficult.
Oliver Stone, better or worse than Sharon Stone?
Oh, I see what you're doing. That's name Stone. Okay. I'm going to still go with Sharon Stone. So worse.
I think Oliver Stone's better. Oliver Platt, better or worse than Oliver Stone?
Well, Oliver Stone's worse. No. Yeah, worse. Worse than Oliver Stone. Yeah.
Yeah, he is worse. Oliver Reed, better or worse than Oliver Platt?
Oh, definitely better. Definitely better. Definitely.
Olivia Colman, better or worse than Oliver Reed?
Worse.
You're going worse with that? Okay. Worse.
She's a high card. Sammy Davis Jr., better or worse than Olivia Colman?
Better.
Way better.
Robert Downey Jr., better or worse than Sammy Davis Jr.?
Worse.
Oh, that's a hard one. I'm going to go worse. But
worse. He'd say so himself.
You're sure of that?
I'm not sure.
I'd love the certainty of it all.
If Robert Downey Jr. said I'm better than Sammy Davis Jr., he would be
Wayne, you scored an 8, which means that you are bang average. You're not as good as Jen Brewster, Thomas Coombs, John Corso, Zoe Lyons, Jason Manfred, Jason Contendi with 10, David Baddiel, Ken Cheng, Mike Drucker, Harry Hill, Dominic Monaghan, Luke Morley with 9. But you are as good as Matthew Crosby, Susie Dent, Charles Heston, Henry Fraser, Eddie Hearn, Davey Heffler, Jason Isaac, Simon West, John Niven, Magical Birds, Matthew Morton, Matt Ico, Miranda Raisin, Griffey Jones, Chris Stark, Baron Aside of RC's 2, Whippin, Michael J. White, and Killian White with 8. And you're better than Richard Herring, James King, Ludie Lynn, Henry Normal, Janet Varney, Johnny Vegas with 7, Gary Delaney, Nell Frizzell, Frank Harper with 6, and poor old Dave McLean with 5. So you've done...
Did I hear Janet Varney's name in the middle of that? Wow, that's incredible. Yeah,
You've beaten her.
I'm not super competitive when it comes to this, even though it's obviously a complete reflection of my intellect. But once I kind of learned about you, it was one of those, I felt like I gained speed as I was like, Nathaniel.
That's how it works.
Yeah. How long does it take you to come up with that list of the names?
It takes me too long. It takes really too long. I spend about an hour doing it.
What? For that little 1 minute of entertainment?
You betcha.
You say it's 1 minute of entertainment, but it's got us international recognition, Wayne. worth every hour that Nathaniel's put into it. We've got to go. Thank you for being our guest. Oh, don't go anywhere, Wayne. But I'm thank you for being our guest. And we will say it's goodbye from me. Welcome to the club, Wayne. It's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Nathaniel. And it's goodbye from Wayne. Everybody, look after yourselves, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you very much. Goodbye.